Hello, and welcome to Proofing and Lies, a baking and social science podcast. Today, we are short one Riley, but we have gained one Dr. Thomas LeCocq. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on.
I am so excited to have you on because we're going to talk about something that I've been thinking a lot about and I've been watching with a mixture of horror and fascination, which is the Musk takeover of Twitter. But this is a baking and social science podcast. So did you bake anything good for Thanksgiving?
I do not do the baking for Thanksgiving, which is something that brings great joy to everyone else. My wife does the baking for Thanksgiving. And we had a lot of baked goods. Four pies, which were rapidly demolished, an apple crumble top, a pecan, and then two pumpkins that did none of which made it out of the day after Thanksgiving. And it was beautiful. I miss them deeply.
The pie is not your family, right?
It can be both. Yes. Definitely meant my family. Definitely not the beautiful pies.
I had some grand visions for what I was going to make for Thanksgiving, but then it ended up the day of, or like the week of, I had a lot of family stuff going on. And so I only made one pumpkin pie this whole holiday, but I was pretty proud of it. It had like a very cool crust, which I will throw up on the Instagram, which is at Proofing and Lies on Instagram. So I put some like little baked elements on top of the pie. Because I think that's really the difference between like a homemade pie and a pie that looks like it could, you know, go on Instagram is just putting like a couple extra little bits of pastry on top.
Oh, that makes really sense. Yeah. Did you finish it all the first night, or did you indulge in breakfast pie the next day? Because I think breakfast pie is a very important part of having pie.
So it was actually a really small Thanksgiving. So I've talked on the pod before that I am from a large Catholic family. So Thanksgiving is usually like a 60 person event. But this year we had some stuff going on. So it was just my parents and one of my sisters. So just four of us. And my sister Rita does not like cinnamon. So it was just three of us who could eat the pie. Not that it made it that much further from breakfast the next day, but it did take us more than 48 hours to power through.
Excellent.
So I was proud of that one. I'll throw that on the Instagram. Okay, so we've gotten through the fun and lighthearted bit. Now on to the worst thing that's happened to academic Twitter since that one professor threw graded papers at her students.
Oh man, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
If she's a listener, I did not join that pile on. It was just the first example I could think of.
Yeah. Oh, the subtle joys of academic Twitter. So subtle and so deeply missed now that it's falling apart.
It really is falling apart. I think there was sort of the first day he took over, there was this mass exodus, or at least people tweeting that they were going to mass exit. And there was this sense that like Twitter could go out at any moment. And now it seems like we've stabilized a little, but it is noticeably different. Just a very different sense of foreboding almost, would you say?
Yes. So it's the three things. They're probably more than three things. There are three things that immediately come to mind. There's the fact that a bunch of people just immediately up and left for other sites that claim to be Twitter-esque, but different. Mastodon, Hive Social, Counter Social, Post. I'm sure we'll get a bunch of new ones. And so a bunch of people just like immediately left. And a lot of academics immediately left. And I find it very interesting who has left and who has stayed. And I'm going to try to be as polite about it as possible because I like many of the people who have left. But it is noticeable that many of the people who are still on Twitter are people who have benefited greatly from Twitter. It is people who are graduate students. It is people who are in precarious positions. It is people who are maybe, you know, permanent jobs or tenure track, but at small schools outside of the corridors and regions of power. It's people who are at predominantly teaching institutions and underfunded ones. It's people who Twitter has opened up doorways to having a voice and having networking opportunities and publishing opportunities and that has built careers for people who are traditionally outside of the realms of power. And I'm going to be very explicit that I have benefited enormously from Twitter. And an awful lot of that benefit is I exist in a societal position of power. I am a white, cisgender, heterosexual man with tenure. And Twitter has allowed me to overcome in many ways the fact that I am at a small teaching school in Iowa to have a much bigger platform than I would otherwise. And so my vision of Twitter is much rosier than other people's visions of Twitter, despite the fact that I get harassed by trolls on a fairly regular basis and I have mobs sent against me and things like that. But that's me choosing to vocally engage in topics that are going to get this to happen, not because of my identity, but because I decide to visibly engage with them in ways that benefit me in theory, while also giving me nightmarish interactions with horrible people on Twitter. Twitter, it's an experience. So a lot of people have stayed, but it's been noticeable that a lot of people have left are people who Twitter might be an interesting way for them to engage, but it has not noticeably advanced their own networking potential. The other thing is that Twitter is getting worse on just a general level because so many people have been fired. And that has like a real impact. I haven't noticed it on Android app as much, but I keep seeing people who are having issues where just it won't load, where their feed has gotten weird, where, you know, people are having problems with two-step verification. And I think that kind of aspect where there's going to be a degradation of the actual service of Twitter will become more and more noticeable and bigger problem. And then three, and the kind of big one, it's the fascism. It's all the fascists. It's all the people whose accounts have been suspended for like overt calls of violence, overt fascist behavior, anti-Semitism. I mean, Kanye has managed to, we found the line where anti-Semitism goes too far. It's apparently posting the Raelian symbol on Twitter, but like, that's how far you have to go to posting the old Raelian symbol, which is Kanye West after his Alex Jones InfoWars interview, where he was busy talking about all of the virtues of Hitler to the point where Alex Jones was trying to push back against the overtness of his positivity towards Hitler, was posting pictures from his car driving around and posted a screenshot of the symbol of the Raelian new religious movement, that the old one, which was a swastika inside a Star of David. And that got Kanye banned from Twitter again, but that's where you have to get to. Otherwise, a huge number of accounts that have been suspended permanently have been welcomed back, and they're overwhelmingly far-right accounts. Simultaneously, a number of accounts of people who do active anti-fascist work have been suspended for little or no cause in ways that feel like Elon Musk is simply showcasing his political preferences through the fact that he dropped $444 billion to be able to own the libs.
Yeah, there's so much going on here. I miss the days when I was an alarmist, if that makes sense. I started doing digital sociology in 2015.
Oh,
and man. Yeah, and so that was a time when we could have really stopped a lot of this.
Yeah.
This was before QAnon really got going in 2017. So like 2015 was sort of the prime time we could have actually like done some intervening. And nobody thought that was anything we needed to think about or worry about. And now people are kind of like, we've got people posting swastikas on one of the most popular social media platforms. And now people are like, oh, should we regulate this? And oh, it's a little late.
Oh.
A little late now.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating as someone who studies political sociology, Twitter has literally been necessary infrastructure to topple regimes.
Yep.
So to put that power in the hands of a very petty tyrant, some of the accounts that are getting banned for saying things like Grimes dumped Elon, which is an objective fact, but also, okay.
Yeah.
You own an emerald mine. Why do you care?
Don't you? I mean, the thing about Elon Musk is that he makes such a terrible supervillain, right? Because he's so petty and grievance-based, and it's like little things. Like, couldn't you build buy an island somewhere and build a secret lab and like, I don't know. Could you just do like normal supervillain things and leave the rest of us alone until you've completed your plan? No, you're going to personally like be name searching yourself to punish people who dare speak out about like really normal things about your petty grievances. That pettiness is the worst part, right? Because there are objectively terrible people who do not care what small people say about them on the internet, because they're terrible and they're incredibly wealthy and they use their money to engage in large scale atrocity. Elon Musk is happy to fund that as well. He just also wants the personal touch of engaging in the pettiness. And because Twitter has been so useful, it really is disruptive.
When I was thinking about the ways you were talking about how it helps people in advance in their careers, because right before this happened, I had just solicited from you some tips for grad students who want to use Twitter. And like the day after I posted that, because I'm running a blog now, the day after I posted that, it was like, oh, Twitter's a mess now. Junior scholars, this is going to be nothing for you. And some of that's true, some of that's not true. There's still a lot going on Twitter. I've still found useful things there. But I primarily, outside of research, use Twitter as a news source. And a lot of people are going to be like, ew, no. What I do is I follow journalists on the ground, journalists that I've vetted and that I trust or who have been recommended by people I trust. So I often get local breaking news before it makes national headlines. And so I am addicted to the news, but I don't use mainstream news networks. I don't watch the news. I follow specific journalists who cover the topics I care about. And Twitter was my way of aggregating all of that, except now my feed is scrambled. Yeah. I don't know if those journalists have been blocked or banned on Twitter. I don't know if the algorithm's not promoting their tweets anymore, but I have to really dig to find the people I've intentionally followed for news sources.
And it's a huge problem, especially when you're trying to write about contemporary events, because it's also, this is the easiest place for academics to interact with journalists and to build kind of relationships with them and to be able to not only follow, but, you know, write for these different places. For me, that's the biggest thing about Twitter is that posting about the Iowa caucus, I'd say rest in peace, but it's good that Iowa has been removed from the caucus process. That's a conversation for another time. But it was like tweeting about events when I was watching Democratic candidates at the caucus that put me in contact with journalists that eventually led me to writing my first piece for the Washington Post, which eventually led to like my entire secondary area of focus where I write public articles about contemporary events that unfortunately relate to religious violence and apocalypticism. Like it has made my second career. And it's because of this kind of fertile ground where you get to interact with everyone. It's very much not siloed. It's the general mess of a sphere where journalists and academics hang out and talk about serious things and also like rant about pop culture and also make meme jokes together. And it built community. And I miss that already.
I know. Well, and so you mentioned that part of this is the actual app is running worse because we've lost pretty much anyone who could walk away has walked away. So the staff of Twitter is essentially people who are really big on Musk and people who are on work visas.
Yes.
Who physically cannot leave. It sounds a little bit like human labor trafficking.
I mean, it's a hostage situation to a certain extent. It's Elon Musk got rid of a bunch of people and then made people promise to be willing to work abusive hours and agree to it in writing to be able to stay. And so the people are there, need the job. They're probably a handful of like diehard Muskian acolytes, whatever. I think most of the images that have been circulated from like venture capitalists who are supporting Musk in this, but it's a lot of people who have to have this job. And so have to say yes to these work conditions. But because all the colleagues
are like grad school.
I mean, ow, not wrong, but ow. But I gotta be honest. Yeah. Well, it's the cult aspect, right? You have some people who are cultists and some people who have simply, there's the sunk cost fallacy that we've come too far. We can't escape from grad school. Yeah. We can't escape from Twitter.
Some of us ascend. Look at us.
Yeah. Have we ascended? I mean,
well, we're talking about Twitter on a podcast. So I think we've reached the pinnacle of academia.
Oh, fair enough. No, this is the actual dream. I just wish that we were celebrating its glory instead of mourning its demise. It's not dying. It's not going to go anywhere. I really like the problem is that it's just being made. I no longer believe that Twitter is going to collapse because the cuts have stopped. The money hemorrhaging hasn't, but Twitter has always been hemorrhaging money and he's simply making it worse because I have to assume Musk genuinely thought that if he made it a free speech hellscape that people would just show up in droves or something like that. But what it does is it drives away advertisers because the problem is that the loudest people in the far right media sphere yell all the time about being censored. But advertisers don't want to be advertising their products on a site filled with Nazis. That's why Parler was thinking about selling itself to Kanye West. And it no longer is because even Kanye West has gone too far for Parler, right? The problem with Gab is that Gab's founder is a vicious anti-Semite. No one wants to advertise for Gab. Truth Social, I can only assume, is losing tons of money. because nobody outside of the sphere, like your big, if your biggest advertiser is MyPillows, like you have a problem. And the problem is that I think Musk lives in such, in the same kind of way that we all can curate our information ecosystems. I think Musk's information ecosystem is simply people so deeply involved in right-wing chat spaces that he thought that there was a huge market, that if he simply took it and opened up free speech, that everyone would join him and the money would roll and this would be perfect. And what you discover instead is that it's really not blogs. It's just people who are bad at grammar. It's not the free speech that's the problem. It's the continued flow of Nazis that's the problem. That international laws are really difficult to deal with when you decide to just try to fire everyone in a single mass email and refuse to have content moderation. And that advertisers want to not be selling their products in a space filled with Nazis. And he's either going to collapse his fortune, in which case, I mean, like the Tumblr deal, like fine, we'll stay around merrily helping him burn through his money. And like, that'll feel like a societal good, or he'll have to reverse course, or he'll sell it at a loss. And maybe he has enough money to kill it. I don't know. Maybe he has enough money. They can just burn $44 billion. What do I know? Great. Let's leave him poor.
Let's see if he has money for the lawsuits. I want to back up for a second and talk about some of these incidents, because I hope for my audience's sake that they're not as plugged into Twitter as I am. So a couple things are going on is, one, Elon Musk fired a lot of people in other countries. I think Ireland is one of the big ones. Yes. That have laws that stop people from firing you without cause.
Yes.
So there, he has violated a lot of laws. I think there's some state laws in California he also broke. Yeah. So he's going to be the subject of a lot of litigation. So Elon Musk just sort of does things, because he's never really faced a lot of consequences. And if you look at his history running Tesla, he had racially segregated factories. Oh, God. I mean, he's committed a lot of violations and he really has not faced any serious consequences.
Yeah.
And it would be very entertaining to see if this is it. Maybe this is the thing that gets him, because he's international now. And maybe some of these other countries are going to do things that the US was unwilling to do.
I'm really excited about that possibility, because I think he breezily wandered in thinking that his experience with the European Union would be like his experience with the United States, or he simply, it didn't occur to him that Europe doesn't care.
Yeah.
Right. Europe is not impressed. Europe, like, oh, you make bad electric cars in the United States. That's adorable.
I mean, there's still blood royalty in Europe. They're used to dealing with egos and wealth.
Yeah. I mean, well, and some countries have solutions for that. And I'm just going to keep myself from getting too French in this moment. So Ireland has simply informed the fired employees that they haven't been fired. This is the latest news that, like, no, Ireland as a country has reinstated Twitter employees based in Ireland by, you know, national law. They're like, no, I'm sorry, you have to pay them. You have to keep them on staff. You don't have a choice. In Brussels, if I remember correctly, the European Union has threatened to shut down Twitter in Europe because it's not meeting certain standards for the company, because they fired their entire content moderation team. So like, they're either going to put them back or it's going to be banned from Europe.
Wow.
And if it's banned from Europe, why would anyone bother advertising on Twitter? And then it goes into the financial death spiral, in which case, like, we will all be here. It's again, if Musk doesn't reverse course very quickly, it's going to be purely a US audience. It is going to be a unending money draining pit. And he's going to be trapped in here with us until he bans all of us individually for making fun of him for it. And that is going to be really sad for me, because I have worked very hard to use Twitter in productive ways. But if we have to go out in a blaze of glory, like making Elon Musk not one of the top five richest people on the planet, I mean, I guess that's where we go.
Yeah.
Be a noble cause, I suppose.
I think
I'm really mad about it. But
there's part of me that's like, you know, maybe it'll be good for me to get off the app and stop doom scrolling. But the other part of me is like, Twitter has enabled so much political change that I really don't think we will appreciate for another 20 years.
No.
I mean, we have seen the movement for Black Lives existed before Twitter,
yeah.
But Twitter really catapulted it into the white mainstream.
Yep.
And so, you know, its ability to allow outsiders into in-groups, right? So you start seeing like Black Twitter is such a huge force for cultural change and just cultural production. Yeah. I mean, the number of jokes and memes and things that we've gotten from Black Twitter, sometimes exploitatively, but I mean, it's a gathering place that has kind of this semblance of privacy, but it's also very, very public. And it's been a way for marginalized groups to get power.
Yeah.
I remember this was years ago, there was a study on campus isolation. So you might be the only like Black student in the freshman class of your small liberal arts college. But if you tweet about some racist incident, you can get the support of national or international activists. So all of a sudden, yes, you do have this huge, very visible, very public space where you get support and you can get change, or at least addressing something that happened.
Yes. Well, and there are massive organizations in this country designed to provide support and financial backing and legal aid for right-wing grievance mongering on college campuses. And the opposite does not exist for all of the kind of massive appeal to like universities or liberal spaces indoctrinating students. What ends up happening is that you have massive right-wing organizations who exist to support people in airing their grievances in ways that are incredibly disruptive and destructive towards faculty and organizations and on college campuses. And then universities fold under that pressure because they don't have a countersuit. The opposite does not exist, but Twitter has provided a space for people to draw in support from international community in this way when there are these moments, to gain support when they're being attacked by other organizations, when the instances of hate speech happen on campus, things like this.
I just think, I mean, the mechanism for virality can be bad, right? The Twitter main character, which if you're not active on Twitter, is typically there is always some ongoing controversy where someone has tweeted something they think is benign, but it's actually the worst take in the history of the world. Bean dad might be a term that you're familiar with if you are on Twitter. Yeah.
Milkshake duck.
Yes, milkshake duck is classic. Mm. The shrimp tail guy, right? Like, I mean, there are these cultural touchstones, right? Of the ways that virality can be very bad, like public shaming.
Yes. But
other platforms don't really have the same virality, which can be used for very good things, right? Like protests in Iran, there were viral threads about following the on-the-ground coverage of these protests.
Yeah. Well, and because people don't watch the news, but people spend a lot of time on social media, it became a way that people could become aware of international incidents that hit that level of virality, which again is very subjective. What international atrocities become important to the people who can make them popular on Twitter, right? It's not that it erases the barriers that set the silos of knowledge and the silos of caring. It's that because of the way legacy media typically portrays world news, that we hear about instances in some places more than others, and we move, the news cycle moves on much more quickly than actual damage happens. Twitter has become a way of broadening out our scope and capacity for empathy well beyond our own groupings, our own countries, and then the way that kind of American society has racialized empathy for foreign countries, right? It broadens out the ability to feel empathy and to care about crises happening around the world by making it feel present and real because you're seeing it in your social media in a way that you wouldn't if you were just watching the evening news. And that's important. That's a really important thing. It's been one of the benefits of Twitter. You know, it's watching protests happen. It's watching, you know, it's unfortunately the videos of atrocities that are committed that are publicized across Twitter and then are part of our popular consciousness and get recorded and have been seen and can't be covered up because you're live streaming from your phone, right? It's the organization of the Arab Spring and then the broadcasting of what's happening in the Arab Spring around the world in the early days of Twitter. And it's the, you know, organization of groups to join the activists who have already been doing the work after the murder of George Floyd. And it is, there are nuggets of genuine good that come out of Twitter, in addition to the vast seas of kind of banal memes and jokes, and then also the, like the pleasant interactions that aren't going to shape history. But you have all of it. You have the good and you have the bad and you have the nonsensical, and it all exists in a singular space. And so not only are you making jokes with your friends, but you're also reading cutting edge news and you're also interacting with people in your field. And you're also seeing activists trying to bring light to issues that you would never hear about because you're a white Midwestern small town kid who ended up back in the Midwest in a college professor job, right? It's opening up the world to point out the ways that the comfort of your existence does not govern the world, and that other people's existence and life is very different, and forcing you to engage with your privilege and also pay attention and care.
I wonder, do you think, can we go back? You know, can we live in a post-Twitter world? I think in some ways, now that we know what's possible, I don't know. I think Mastodon's not it. I'm not going to lie. This is not sponsored by Mastodon.
Good, because I would ruin your sponsorship deal if we moved on to that topic.
I'm just saying, if they want me to change my tune, they can sponsor this podcast. But until then, I won't be joining that platform. I wonder, like, now that we know that there could be a space like this, can we really go back to social media apps that don't have this? Because I think Twitter is so far beyond what it's set out to be. Yes. I think it was designed to be one thing, and then it's really the users that made it this powerful tool for connection. And so I think because the users are still going to exist, the users are still out there, they just don't have a digital gathering space, assuming Twitter shuts down, right? Or is just irrevocably damaged by this.
Yeah.
I'm still holding out that he will sell for a loss.
And I hope so.
We can have something like this again. But I just can't imagine not recreating this space somewhere, somehow.
Yes. Well, and I have tried out a number of the alternatives, and Mastodon is siloed by design and is designed to not allow virality. And I understand that conceptually, and that's just not what I want. That's not what Mastodon's designed to do. Those people fleeing Twitter to Mastodon want it to be Twitter, and Mastodon's designed to not be Twitter. So this is us wanting it to be something that it very explicitly set up to not be. Post News, if you've read the terms and conditions, talks about not discriminating against people and based on net worth. And I'm just going to go ahead and say, eat the rich.
A rich person came up with that rule.
Yes.
Because I bet it doesn't work in the reverse.
No, people say all kinds
of very messed up stuff about people living in poverty.
Yes. So I fall into the category. I'm ready to knit my red Phrygian cap. I'm ready to sing the La Marseillaise while I take carpentry lessons, eat the rich. That's definitely not going to be the place to replace it with. Countersocial and Hive Social, I don't have a feel for them yet. And I don't know that I want to spend the time to feel for them yet. I just want Twitter without Elon Musk.
Yeah.
I want to get rid of the petty tyranny of overprivileged, ultra wealthy tech bros who use it as a space to air their personal grievances and then impose them on everyone else. I want it run by professionals who want it to stop being a loss-making engine and consequently want to encourage advertiser return. Real advertisers who want content moderation, who will follow international laws and who will reopen a space that was genuinely a way for me to talk to people in numerous foreign countries while taking in news from around the world, while also talking to friends in the United States. I just want it back. And it's not that it was perfect beforehand. It wasn't. All of the problems that existed beforehand are still there. Elon Musk is just taking some of the more egregious problems and making them significantly worse. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that like people wanted Twitter to go one direction to become better. And what Musk has done instead is taken all of those problems and done everything he can to make them even more egregious.
I think we should give Neopets a try again. a possible alternative. The blog that I've started on my personal website has comments. It is a volunteer staff of me with no experience, but I think I could handle the entire user base of Twitter if they just wanted to use my comment section.
Oh my gosh. So I discovered message boards in the early internet, and I don't want that back. That is not what I want back. That seems like a terrible thing to volunteer to just run message boards out of the comment section.
I'm very confident that won't happen. but I feel like saying that, maybe that's, honestly, traffic is traffic.
Oh, you see, I love that you think that I'm not going to dedicate myself to bringing people into your personal blog space while this lasts. I love your dreams here, and I'm going to make this happen.
Well, I feel like I am playing with fire a little bit here, because I love Twitter. I study social media, but I myself do not have a social media following. I've had one viral tweet, which was very exciting, but like I didn't generate a lot of followers from that. So I have been graced with being a lurker on social media. And I worry someday I'm going to make a joke that is going to change that, and I will become the bean dad.
Listen, I don't know. Your viral tweet is one of the greatest tweets in the history of Twitter. So I know it by memory. You want me to write a dissertation? The thing that killed, did you say the cast of Midsommar? Or everyone
in Midsommar.
It remains one of just the things of beauty.
That was one of the funnier moments of my life because one, it was at one of the lowest points in my personal life. I had just gotten out of a very serious relationship and I was spiraling on Twitter, which is really, that's what Twitter is meant for.
Yes.
But I tweeted that and the Midsommar movie, like official account, who had been silent for over a year, reactivated to retweet that. And it was maybe the highlight of my career. And then one of the most impressive professors that I've ever worked with does not have a Twitter, but found out about it and sent me this lovely email that was about Midsommar Murders, which is a British TV series. And she is such a cool person and so prestigious. I just never corrected her. So she thinks that I have this like viral tweet about a very old British TV murder mystery series. And I love that.
Well, I adore that. I just adore that. But yes, this is the beauty of Twitter, is the way that Twitter escapes Twitter and becomes part of other people's world. My favorite thing is that I have had a couple of big tweets this year that made it to Reddit. My students who are not on Twitter have found them on Reddit. They made it into like people's Instagram feeds would be like major accounts Instagram feeds would do it. I had the actor who plays Turk from Scrubs. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Was posting my tweet on his Instagram. And this is how this is how I discovered that this had made it on there, is that Donald Faison had posted my tweet in his story.
I'm just realizing in this moment, there is a small, but not zero possibility that Florence Pugh has seen my tweet.
Nothing would surprise me about Florence Pugh. She's amazing. And having seen your tweet would be like the coolest thing ever.
Well, and you can see the analytics. So apparently 8 million accounts have seen my tweet.
Yeah.
And that doesn't count things like these Reddit and Instagram circulations, because you end up on all these different listicles. And so it is crazy that with, I think I had at the time 500 Twitter followers, I somehow made a joke that went out to potentially 8 million people. I mean, how many of those are bots or duplicate accounts? That's the asterisk as a researcher I want to put next to it.
Yeah.
But I mean, imagine if instead of a joke that had been like some really important research.
I mean, my biggest tweet this year was me making fun of all the racists who were concerned about The Little Mermaid. But the second biggest one was the thread that led to me writing an article on the Crusader rifle.
The Jesus and Babies?
No, not even that article. It was the one that ended up with the Holy Gun Crusade for Religion Dispatches.
Yes. Okay.
That Twitter thread was the second biggest thing that I've done this year. And I then wrote it up into an article immediately after it blew up. That was the second biggest thing. And I think I gained something like 10,000 followers from it.
And it's okay. First of all, the idea that you gained 10,000 followers. Oh my God.
I mean, there is no reason why people should follow me on Twitter. It makes no sense.
No, you're very funny.
That's very kind of you. I don't see it, but like, if people are amused, that's great. But like, I had carefully over the course of like a decade gotten myself up to about 15,000 followers by February. And I was like, I don't know how this has happened. And how it happens is you get a couple of viral tweets. It was me talking about the Crusades in the context of modern Islamophobes and like posting commentary on people's like deeply racist threads and like educating them, and by educating them and trolling them using history. And then I had this one piece and I gained another 10,000 followers in like 2 weeks. And it was very weird and it remains very weird. And now that's like everyone else with a big account, that's gently declining as people flee Twitter. But it's an interesting moment that you can have viral tweets and they can be jokes or they can be threads. And then sometimes it blows up your account. And sometimes those ways are great. Sometimes those ways are terrible. Sometimes you're attacked by fascists for the next month. But like, it's usually both end. It's the peril of Twitter, but it's also the possibility.
I think it's also the peril of being a public person, right? There's some really interesting stuff written about like how this works for women, at least, because when you're in the public, as a woman, like there are certain risks and rewards that come with that. But I think just the idea, as someone who might spend a year or 7 years writing something that I feel like is really important, and maybe like six people read it, right? This is a way to immediately get your work to people and to a lot of people. And it's been such an incredible tool as someone who reads a lot, but can't read enough, right? So if I know of a scholar working in my area or related to my area, I follow them and get summaries of all the different work they're doing that I would never be able to read on my own time. And so it's just been such an incredible resource. And I'm very angry that it is getting so much worse.
And it's especially getting so much worse for those of us who are in academia and who have used this as a way of making connections, because there are lots of people who are fleeing Twitter for a lot of different reasons, but it does feel like academic Twitter is working as aggressively as possible to dismantle itself. And especially the kind of community where people could interact with really famous professors and things like that, it feels like that part is collapsing. It's really unfortunate. I mean, for all of the reasons that you've laid out, like you learn about new scholarship, you learn about people that you wouldn't know through your own social networks. You can engage in the interesting discussions and publications in other fields that you're not part of, but you're interested in for whatever reason. There are all kinds of things that people have said about the negative aspects of academic Twitter, and I could talk at great length about some of the negative aspects of academic Twitter and won't. What I will miss about academic Twitter, if not Twitter in general, is that it has fundamentally transformed my own scholarship by exposing me to ways that the themes I'm interested in exist in other time periods and providing me with introductory scaffolding and contacts and CFPs. And I mean, like I work on Vast Early America now, and I work on Vast Early America because of Twitter.
Yeah.
Right. I write public history pieces now, and I write public history pieces because of Twitter. And whatever negative aspects of that, that's a part that I will feel that loss.
I feel like this has become a little bit of a Twitter eulogy.
I don't think Twitter is going anyway, but no. Academic Twitter seems to be working as hard as possible to dismantle itself.
And I think that's so frustrating. I feel like, and this is not going to surprise anyone who listens to this podcast, but I love my local library. And as a kid, you know, I did a lot of activities at the library, and the library is such a hub of the community where it's not just where you get information, it's where you get all kinds of things, all kinds of resources, all kinds of connections and meetup groups. And, you know, there's a crochet group at my local library now. And it's like as if they had privatized the library, and the person who owns it now, it's not that they want you dead, but they're not going to fire the librarian who is saying that you should be murdered. And so it's suddenly not a community space. It is just a space for people to hang out and talk about how much they wish you were dead. And it's like, oh, okay, so not only is this no longer a resource, this is going to be an active threat in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent way to put it. And it's really sad and completely unnecessary, and may even be reversed. But even if it's reversed, I guess the fundamental question remains, would you ever feel safe in that space again?
Well, and part of what's going on is it's not just the ideologies that are dangerous. It is the incompetence. Yeah. So at different points, the Twitter code has been streamlined. I'm using air quotes, which the listeners can't see, but parts of the code were altered so that people you have blocked can message you again, right? So people who have, you know, sent you death threats can now suddenly contact you again. Legally, there's an issue with they deleted some part of the code that prevented people from uploading copyrighted materials.
This people were uploading things that have been banned for hate speech, videos. People were posting for a day videos of the Christchurch mosque shooting. They're posting snippets from that live stream.
So it's not just that, you know, oh, will we ever reclaim the space? I think now we can't look away from just how dangerous this space is. And before Musk, I want to be really clear, before Musk, Twitter was not good at handling this stuff. It's not like it went from okay to bad. It went from bad to much more dangerous.
Yeah.
So it's just really frustrating to see this happening, and especially to have this happen in the name of free speech. Because what drives me crazy is when people on the right talk about free speech, what they mean is Nazism. It's almost only about about fascism, because they're not advocating for pornography to be on the site. They're not advocating for, you know, extreme leftist views. If you want to talk,
they're banning them.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
They're going very hard against progressive creatives or journalists. A lot of human rights groups have been banned on Facebook and on virtually every app, because moderation is really, especially AI moderation, is very bad at distinguishing between people talking about hate speech and people using hate speech.
Yeah.
So there's a lot wrong with moderation on the best platforms. But then you take these, you know, typically white billionaires talking about free speech, and they just mean the free speech to be Nazis.
Yeah.
And COVID deniers, which is tied into Nazis.
Which we've now, there's no longer even a category to report COVID denial, because that's just fine in Musk's universe. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sighs and sad looks are about what I have for it at the moment.
I will say, so one of the projects I've been trying to get up off the ground, but haven't had the right combination of funding and time, is how researchers who do want to engage with the public, how they can protect themselves a little bit. And a lot of the successful strategies include having someone else read your DMs and, you know, being the first screener. So if you find yourself on the end of some viral harassment, you have someone else dealing with it. But I wonder, as someone who has had to deal with trolls and threats on Twitter, how do you recommend people, as it gets a little more unstable, that they protect themselves and their well-being?
I'm going to give the most honest answer I can, which is that I am a terrible person to ask this question to, because I am a white, cisgendered, heterosexual man with tenure. The only thing that worries me is threats to my job, and my university has been very clear that tenure is tenure and that this is free speech. So I don't have useful strategies. I approach this as much of a game as I can for my own mental well-being, and I simply insult trolls back. And that is a strategy that is only viable because of my university's position on free speech, the fact that I do not claim university affiliation, and that this is purely my own speech on this, and that I'm a white dude. I'm just a white dude. It makes it so that the kind of harassment I get is minimal, that the kind of harassment I get is usually not death threats, and that I am not targeted by any of the more genuinely dangerous and malevolent organized institutions. I don't make a great target for incels, right? I'm a white dude. I'm not gonna have sex with them either, but they don't care about that, right? I don't, like, the Klan is not coming after me. The neo-Nazis are not coming after me, because I am not Jewish, and they focus on that. I did have someone call me Jewish this week because they disagreed with my opinion, and I looked in their timeline and they were just Nazi, and it was very clear within a couple of seconds they were Nazi, which is part of the breakdown of things, because actually French and German Twitter laws don't allow you to have, like, overt neo-Nazi references on there, and my Twitter is set to French Twitter, and so the fact that we're starting to have those guys slip through is an interesting part of the code breaking down. Also proof that there were mechanisms in place to ban overt Nazi accounts, and they chose not to impose that everywhere. Which is,
love that.
I hate that for all of us. But it's my strategies are not viable, because my strategies come from an immense position of privilege, which is why I engage in troll bashing in such glee, because most people cannot.
Well,
most people would have real problems for most people doing what I do, because the harassment campaigns would be massive and widespread. And so that's the trick, right? I can't give useful advice, because my useful advice is to be a white man. And that's how I get away with the kind of nonsense I do on Twitter.
I do know people who have two accounts. One is their sort of linked to their personal identity, and one that's not. I mean, I think there are ways that dedicated people can figure that out. I think one of the best things I did in grad school, and then I did it again when I moved for my postdoc, is talk to my supervisors very bluntly about what they would support and what they wouldn't support on social media. So if you're in a position like that, where you think your social media presence could lead to work conflict, knowing whether or not your supervisors would support you is helpful. And if you don't feel like you can have that conversation with your supervisors, that's a good sign that you should be really careful about your social media presence. So I think those are my strategies. As a white young woman, I'm protected in some ways and vulnerable in some other ways online. And I would also caution, as someone who does digital research and works in violence prevention, do not trust that anonymity in your handle will protect you from harassment in your real life.
Yeah.
It is for someone who is a little bit unhinged, you will be findable.
Yeah.
There's a whole TikTok that's actually dedicated to a woman who says, try to stump me, try to create a burner account. And within usually a few strategies, she can find the person down to their home address.
Yep.
And then she puts it on TikTok, which I don't know why you would sign up for that, because I would not want to be put on blast like that. But
no, seems like a terrible idea. Yeah.
If she's a listener, please don't do that to me.
Yeah.
But do plug the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I want to be mindful. I also don't want to spiral out too much over the death of Twitter as we know it. So,
well, this is the Twitter is how we met.
Yeah. Well, so, I think Zach was how we met.
That's right. But Zach, I got back in contact with Zach because of Twitter.
Ah, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Twitter is the glue.
It is. It of many of the random encounters of my life in the last decade. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, honestly, Twitter is the glue. It's either a glue trap or like bringing things together.
I love that you said either, as if it's not both.
Oh, good point.
Yeah. No, both end.
Soft spot in my heart for it still.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Thank you so much. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more depressing content.
A special thanks to Minelli Marcelino for our intro and outro music.